Welcome to The Sacred Cheese of Life. This is a podcast about reading literature and writing things and learning from the reading and the watching and the listening and turning that all into better writing. My name's Emma, and I've been writing novels and screenplays for approximately 1 million years. I self-published a bunch of novels. I'm really happy with a trilogy I wrote. I'm working on other things now, and I'm not as happy with them. I keep reading my old book and being like, how am I ever going to write anything like that again? Which is stupid, because you don't write books. You write first drafts, and then you turn the first draft into a second draft and a third draft, etc. I teach literature, and so I'm constantly studying fiction and learning from it and trying to make my own writing better. So I wanted to put those two things together and also be accountable, which I'll talk about later, but be accountable to myself and make this happen. So here we are. Welcome. So I'm going to start off with a short story called The Open Boat by Stephen Crane. This is the story I usually start my literature classes off with because it is older and it is straightforward and it is a very good story, but it's also very accessible. It does a lot of things that I really like in fiction, and I don't do them often enough, and so I'm going to dig into that some. Okay, so the plan is look at a piece of something, fiction. It doesn't even have to be fiction. It could be nonfiction. Look at a piece of creative writing of some kind, and then take it apart, put it back together again, learn what we can from it, and use that in our own work, because everybody needs to learn from reading or listening or watching in order to write better, especially me, because I spend a lot of time by myself, and my writing can be very much in my own head, which I think is a boring place. At least it is for me when I spend too much time alone. It just, you start to loop things, and you repeat, and it's all reruns, and it just gets very stale. And so getting new texts into that, although I read new things all the time, really helps. But studying them makes a big difference. There's reading and then there's studying something. So you can read a thing, it goes into your ears or eyes or whatever. Actually, I guess ears or eyes are pretty much it. Maybe fingers if you're using Braille. And then it just goes through your head and out again, and maybe a little bit remains, but when you study it and take it apart and really figure out what makes it tick, then you get to retain not just what happened, which of course we hope we all get from everything we read and watch and listen to, everything we take in, but also you get to learn from it, and you get to use that in your own writing. So The Open Boat, let me just give you a little bit of background on it, which I should be able to do without looking because I've taught it 10,000 times. The Open Boat by Stephen Crane is from the late 1800s, and it's a story about a ship sinking. A small ship sinks, and he is a correspondent on it. The author was himself on this boat that sank. And so he got into a lifeboat or a little dinghy and survived. Obviously, because he wrote about it afterward. But it's the experience of the ship sinking and getting into this little boat with three other guys and surviving nights and days on the open ocean in an open boat. It's not easy what they did, and they could have died any second, any day, any time, because they're in this tiny little boat and the waves are huge and they have to keep it pointed into the waves as they're coming at them, or it can tip them. It could do it anyway. And then they're out there and they maybe swim for a while and then drown. They die. So they're facing death every moment of the time. And I find that very interesting as far as how it focuses the writer. The writer himself, he replicates this experience in his writing, the way he tells you. And this is where we get to the sacred cheese of life, which is another reason to start with this story. He tells you how that feels to be facing death, not just for a moment, which I think a lot of us have. Like, you can choke on an M&M and face death in your living room. And you can Heimlich yourself by leaning over a chair. Did you know that? Very useful thing to know. I've done it myself. Or the arm of an armchair or something. You can Heimlich yourself. If you're all by yourself, which I always am, except for the animals. So you can face death any minute of the day, and I think we all have in various ways. But also, he and these other three men, they face death constantly for days at a time. And I think that does something to a person. It certainly did something to him. And he replicates that for us in the story. So that's one thing. Death, right? And how it focuses your attention on what life is about and what it's for and how you live it. And he goes into this, and I'll get into this quote a little bit in a minute. But so there's not just facing death every minute of the day, but also just looking at the experience of life. So, and I know we all are alive, obviously, but we don't always notice being alive. Do you know what I mean? It fades into the background. And when he's facing death and they're in this boat and there's no distractions, there's just like the four guys and they're in the boat and they have to bail out the water and they have to keep rowing and they take turns rowing. And when they're not rowing, they sleep in the bottom, except the captain who's injured. So he steers. He sits in the back and he steers with the rudder and tries to keep them aimed into the waves and heading towards shore, which I don't know how they do both of those, but I'm not a boat understander necessarily. I did use this story when I was caught in high winds on Phillips Lake here in Maine in my kayak. And I was like, oh crap, these huge waves kicked up and a kayak has hardly any draft. And so, you know, it's easy to roll them over. I guess they're kind of designed for that, but I've never done it and I never hope to. So the high winds kicked up, the high waves kicked up. I was like, oh no, you got to turn the nose into the waves. And I did that. And my brother was with me and he did it too. And we didn't get tipped. So that was cool. We also had to paddle against these high waves and high winds. And it was ridiculously hard. And anyway, all I could think about was the open boat. So, okay, so they're doing that and they're facing death. But they're in this physical reality the whole time of cold and wet because they're constantly getting splashed. And like I said, when they're not rowing, they go to sleep in the bottom of the boat, which has water in it. So they're in this cold water and they snuggle up against the cook, who somehow, I don't think he rows very much, or he's not. He's usually described as bailing the water out. So they're sleeping and they always feel like they're asleep for just a second before somebody wakes them up and it's their turn to row. So it's this physical reality of the pain in your back from all the rowing, and you're cold and you're wet and your hands hurt and everything hurts, and they haven't really slept for 2 days. And the story says they didn't sleep for 2 nights before the ship sank. Some of them, like the oiler who seems to do most of the work, didn't sleep for 2 nights. He had 2 back-to-back shifts before the ship sank, and he hadn't slept the night before that. So he's exhausted. So there's that physical reality. But there's also the physical reality of the ocean, right? So it's described constantly over and over and over. And he does this thing, Stephen Crane does this wonderful thing that is sort of illegal now, where he replicates the experience in the writing. So he wants to describe the waves that keep coming and coming and coming. And I mean, he's almost funny about it. He is funny about it. You know, he says things like, the thing about a wave is that there's always another wave behind it, which is like, yeah, but we know this, but the experience of it is different from knowing it. And I think that's really interesting in this story. But he replicates that. And I guess that's called the imitative fallacy. But so see, modern writers don't like it. They don't like it when the writing imitates the thing that you're describing. They want you just to describe it. Older writers thought that was cool. I kind of still think it's cool. I like it when people do that. I like it when you're writing something and it's excruciating and somehow the writing is also excruciating, or you're writing something and it's panic-inducing and so the writing is like short little jolts and little exclamations and things like that. Like, I don't mind that. And I know a lot of modern, especially my MFA people, hate it. They hate it. And I can tell you a story about how mad they got when I did it. Maybe I won't, though. Because I don't want anyone to get mad at me. They're going to get mad at me anyway. That's okay. That's their right. So he does the imitative thing and he imitates the waves coming at you. And then again, and then again, and then again, and again, and again. And as you're reading it, you're like, I get it. And then you're like, oh, no, now I get it. Now I get it. Now I get what it feels like. So one thing my lovely MFA professors did like was grounding your writing in physical experiences, in sensory description. And if you can make someone feel the sensory description, then you are winning. And so Stephen Crane wins because he does this constantly. He makes you feel what it's like. So their complaints about the imitative thing maybe aren't on target because he does do what they want you to do, which is to put you in that time and place and make you feel the way the characters feel. And I think that's glorious, and I think that's well worth doing. And so there are certain sections of this. Let me see if I can read a thing. So they're facing death, and they decide they're going to run for the shore. So the waves get higher and higher the closer you get to the shore, I guess, and more dangerous and much more likely to be capsized. So the men, there's 4 of them, there's the captain, the cook, the oiler, and the correspondent. They exchange their addresses so that the others will know where to send notice that they died, right? So talk about facing death. They're like, okay, well, we're going to be pragmatic about it. We're going to tell each other our addresses so that they can notify our next of kin. It's horrifying, right? But it's also mundane, and I think that's great. Oh, that's my dog. Welcome, Tallulah. She will make many appearances, I'm sure. If I cut out every dog bark, this will be 4 seconds long. Although she did make it nearly 11 minutes. Good girl. So they exchanged some addresses. And this, here I'm going to quote. As for the reflections of the men, there was a great deal of rage in them, which I find very interesting. They're so angry. They're angry that it turned out like this. And I think that's a great reaction to imminent death, to be furious. And I love that he puts that in there. Like, they're not accepting. They are being pragmatic about it. They're like, well, let's try to increase our chances of not dying. Let's try to make it so we survive this. And they work very hard to do that. They're like, we're going to run for the shore here. Nope. It's not working out. We're going to go back out. We're going to wait till morning. We're going to do this. We're going to wait. We're going to try to get rescued, etc. They do all these things to try to save themselves. Okay, so they exchange addresses, and then the correspondent goes off into this sort of monologue, which is excellent. He says, as for the reflections of the men, there was a great deal of rage in them. Perchance they might be formulated thus. Quote, if I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, why in the name of the seven mad gods who rule the sea was I allowed to come thus far and contemplate sand and trees? Was I brought here merely to have my nose dragged away as I was about to nibble the sacred cheese of life? It is preposterous. And then, I'm going to cut a little bit. And then, if she has decided to drown me, why did she not do it in the beginning and save me all this trouble? The whole affair is absurd. But no, she cannot mean to drown me. She dare not drown me. She cannot drown me. Not after all this work. End quote. And so he personifies fate as this old ninny woman in the middle there. But if I were his editor, I might trim that out because it's not a person. That's the whole thing about this story. It's not a person doing this to them. It's this implacable force of nature. They're smashing themselves against it like a brick wall. It's not the wall's fault if you go bang your head against it. And that's kind of the whole point of it, is the ocean is just oceaning. It doesn't care if you're there. It does not trying to drown you. It just doesn't care if you drown. It does not care. Nothing cares. And he almost reaches this amazing existential point in this story with this sacred cheese of life thing. Like, what are we doing here? Obviously, you're just trying to survive. Keep breathing. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Have a sandwich. Drink some tea. Keep surviving. That's all you got to do. But also he starts to question what for when it's so hard, which I think is a really interesting thing to put in a story about survival. What are we surviving for? And he puts it all into this image or this metaphor of the sacred cheese of life, right? Which is such a weird thing to say that I'm calling this whole podcast that, because I think that's what a lot of literature is actually about, this sacred cheese of life. Like, what is the thing we're living for? What is it we're after? How do you describe it? And it might be like that feeling of glory when things are great, like you're outside in the yard and it's blue sky and the trees are blowing in the wind and the puppy's so happy. Happiness or peace or calm or joy or whatever it might be. And he puts it all into this image of the sacred cheese of life, which is in a metaphor about like a mouse or a rat in a maze, right? Was I brought here merely to have my nose dragged away as I was about to nibble the sacred cheese of life? I wish I could talk to this man and say, what were you doing with the sacred cheese of life? Do you feel like a rat in a maze? Do you feel like something in a large, uncaring system designed to trick you and trap you? Do you feel like the cheese is something that's only there to keep you doing this stupid thing? Like the cheese in a maze is there to make the mouse or the rat run the maze, because why would they do it otherwise? So I don't know. I don't see life that way. I feel like life is like in the middle of a calm pond, not out on the open boat with the boat constantly about to tip over. But he seems to feel that way. Like, it's just such a frustrating image. Like, it's such a frustrated little critter trying to get to the cheese and can't get the cheese because your nose gets dragged away. Who's dragging your nose away? And he seems to think it's fate. But what is fate? I don't think there is a fate. Like, what is that? And I also don't think we're mice in a maze. I think we're just like doing stuff, and you get to, I guess I did get raised on existentialism in high school with my excellent English teacher, but Mr. McDonald, thank you. But there is no cheese, do you know what I mean? Or it's all cheese. I don't know. I don't know what he's talking about there. I do not understand that metaphor. And as for people trying to survive in an open boat on the ocean, trying to get to the shore, there's a clear goal there, and it's a good goal because it's warm and dry, and there's food, and there's cups of tea, and there's sandwiches, and there's blankets, and people with, at the end, there's like flasks of hot coffee and all of these wonderful things that make life great, you know? I don't think that's a false goal. I don't think that's a tricky goal like the cheese in the middle of a maze, but I also really love the image. of the cheese as something you're going for. You want it so bad, and it's so good. And once you get there, you get to have it, and it's so satisfying, and you're full, and you're happy, and you're warm. So it's a great image, and I also don't know what it means, and I'll probably keep talking about it forever because it's tantalizing. Much like the cheese in a maze, I guess. Like, I'm constantly chasing after that. Like, what is it? What is it? And how do we get it? And once we get it, are we happy? Or, you know, often the cheese is in a mousetrap, right? Like, you put it in a mousetrap, and when you go get it, snap, the trap comes down and kills you. Like, I don't think that's what it is, I hope. So the cheese, I don't know. In his metaphor, he gets dragged away right before he's about to get the cheese. I don't know who's doing that. I don't know. And also, he comes up with this metaphor, and then he fights it. He fights it and fights it and says, you know, why would I get brought all this way to do all this stuff and then just drown? That's stupid. It's like he sees life as a story, and that's a terrible ending, which I agree with. I'm not sure life is a story. I don't know. It doesn't seem like a story. It just seems like a lot of one foot in front of the other, and you get to have some good things and some bad things, and I don't know. I guess that's something to figure out. So there you go. You have the story. You have what it tells. Obviously, there's the story itself, and then there's what it's about, which is about this larger thing, about the purpose of life and what we're trying to do in life and how we're doing it and whether we're succeeding at it and how you even know if you're succeeding at it. And it's framed in a story about four men in a boat who have to go through the surf to get to the shore, and it's rough, and the boat capsizes, and everybody has to jump out or fall out. You're supposed to jump out, apparently, to get away from it so it doesn't land on you and conk you. And only three of them live, which is awful, right? Because you would hope everyone would live, but everybody doesn't make it in this story. He almost gets to that point again at the end where he says, you know, what's it all for? The oiler is the one who dies, and he's the one who did the bulk of the rowing, so he's probably why. He was exhausted, right? But why should you have to work so hard for all of this and then have it add up to nothing? Like, there's the oiler face down in the surf, and they were comrades in arms or whatever, right? Like, they bonded during this ordeal, and then the one of them dies. Why? Why did he have to die? Why did they have to lose one of their team? There's no reason, really, except maybe he did more of the work and he was exhausted from the double shift before the shipwreck, etc. It's not a shipwreck if the ship just sinks, I guess. So at the end, you have this story, these things happened. Okay, yes. But what does it mean? What does it mean that they suffered through all this stuff and then at the end they lost one of their own anyway? But three of them lived, so that's very good. And they kind of lived because of the oiler's work, so that's awful to live with. It's also a good Hollywood ending, right? Like, the one who works super hard to save everybody dies at the end. That seems to happen a lot, like the hero who saved everyone dies. It's an interesting story. I mean, obviously I could talk about it all day, and I have. So what do we take away from it? That's the question, right? Sensory writing, obviously very, very good. Puts you in it, makes you feel it. If you can make somebody's skin shiver because they can feel a paper cut right on their fingertip slice, then you're doing something good. You're getting people into the story so that they're living it with you. That's very good. He also makes you ask big questions, and I honestly think all writing needs to do this. All writing, from every short story to every poem to every song, every movie, every TV show, it should make you ask big questions about, I don't know, life and behavior and how we treat each other. Teamwork, like this bonding in this story, these four men working together to survive, is a great story. It's great to think about. Like, and my students always say, like, if this was a modern story, there would have been like fights or people would have had conflict, but they just worked together. There was no conflict. They all did their utmost, right? And I think that's an interesting commentary also, that they always say that. Like, I can't believe they didn't fight. I was expecting people to fight. I'm like, yeah, no, it's an old story. So, and it's also probably just what happened. Like, they didn't, and maybe this is what would happen in reality. You put all that stuff aside and you just buckle down and you do the work. You bond together and you work together and you make it happen for everybody's good. Like, to me, that's a really good story to tell about human nature. And I'm a little worried about how cynical youth are, but they get that from fiction too, right? Like, they've had a lot more fiction than reality. So they expect complications, they expect infighting, they expect conflict. Hopefully we have less of that in reality than we have in fiction. I think we have to. Couldn't have more. So there's that. There's big questions. There's the sacred cheese of life. He gives you something to take home with you, like in a gift bag, right? Like, I used to look at these Baby Bell cheeses and always think the sacred cheese of life. Like, I don't know. There's just something about cheese. I'm not allowed to eat cheese anymore. Because of certain illness that is never going away, and it makes me very sad. No cheese, no alcohol, no meat, no fat other than olive oil, no bread, no wheat, no sugar, no salt. Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, this is where I'm in the open boat, and I'm like, sacred cheese of life, come on, man. What are we doing here? But it probably, if I didn't think that was food so often, I wouldn't be in this pickle. So what is it? How do we get it? It's obviously other people and experiences, like the things you remember the most, climbing up a mountain and you're at the top and you're looking around and it's amazing and you did the thing. That's a great feeling. And I almost want to have like a file of awesomeness, of just here's what it's for, here's what it's about. And I think the more we think about that, the more we're able to do it. And then the more you're able to do it, the more you're able to have those experiences and be happy. It's about happiness, isn't it? And satisfaction and survival. And maybe that's why I cheese is a good metaphor, because cheese is happiness. No, it isn't. But it is. Like, it hits you right in the center of your brain where all the good stuff lives. And you go, oh, I just had a Baby Bell Gouda. And now I'm so happy. Except I would not be. I would be super sick for days. Oh, I'm going to cry. No more cheese. There is actually Yetost in my fridge right now, which I bought in a fugue state, along with bread, which I'm also not allowed to have. And so it's a life of crime I'm living right now, and I have the asthma to show for it. Notice how I can't breathe. Okay, so anyway, bringing that into your own writing, the sensory stuff. I tend to write way too fast, and I go through stories way too fast. And I mean, like, she goes to the dining hall and she eats lunch, and then afterwards, and I'm like, wait, after, when I go and read it later, I'm like, wait, what happened? What actually happened? And my professors used to complain about that too. They're like, slow down, what happens? Live in the moment for a little. And I'm like, well, yeah, my writing first drafts tend to be almost like outlines. Like, I have to go back and fill it in later. What did she have for lunch? Did she have salmon? Did she have salad? Did she have a grilled cheese? What did she eat? And why did she eat that thing? And those are opportunities. That's character, that's story, that's, you know, it's everything. That is the, that's the part we're there for. We're not there to find out what happens necessarily. Although we want to find out what happens, but we're there to enjoy the ride more. I guess that's the philosophy I take away from the open boat. It's not just about getting to the shore. It's about how it feels getting to the shore. And the part where you're in the boat with the other people, that is life, right? Oh, this story. What am I working on? I always want to end on something I'm working on. Right now, I'm trying to write that thing about this girl, Becca, who is a foster kid who goes off to college and has absolutely no support, nothing backing her up, which is an awful feeling, and it's very hard for these kids, and I've met a bunch of them over the years. They are on their own in a way people aren't very often in our culture. I mean, maybe you are if you just like up stakes and go somewhere new, which I do all the time, or I used to, but they're in college, which is a hugely overwhelming environment. They're surrounded by a million people all the time and not very much real connection until they make friends and build bonds and whatnot. So they're really in a little open boat all on their own. And so that's something I wanted to explore, like that kind of, because a lot of foster kids grow up with a real lack of ability to trust people because of, you know, like being passed from here to there and here to there and here to there over and over and over. And as soon as they feel like they've made a bond, whoops, they're off to the next place. And so they have a really hard time trusting. And actually my dog is the same way for the same reason. She was adopted and returned at least twice, and in foster places, I know, after that and during that and between that, and by the time I got her, she was like, if you want to talk about anxious, avoidant attachment, that's my dog. She doesn't really trust anybody. She likes people. She likes me, but she doesn't really trust. And so, I mean, I have a lot of that myself. Sorry, Miss Puppy. But it's something I'm very interested in. And so I'm trying to write this novel. I wrote a first draft. It sucked. And so I'm trying to rewrite it. It sucked because it missed all the good stuff. It was in a rush, of course, and it missed all of the heart of it, which is, again, what we're there for. We want to know, who is a student of mine read a screenplay, this is 20, almost 25 years ago now, read a screenplay and said, "Where's all the sweet loving?" And I'm like, "What? What are you talking about?" And he's like, "They all jump to the end. Nobody lives in the middle. Where's all the part? Where's all the good stuff? Where's all the heart of it? You're just skipping to the end." Everybody complains about this in my writing. And that's all first drafts, but I do get it in there later. But first drafts, yeah, I'll skip. First drafts are an outline. And so I've got this sort of an outline draft that has a story, but it's her trying to figure out how to trust people and who to trust. How in the world do you figure out who to trust? You trust the wrong people and you learn, whoa, whoops, don't trust that person. But you can't extrapolate. Do you know what I mean? Like, maybe you can a little bit. Like, don't trust people who take food off your plate because those people are boundary pushers and da 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 da. Maybe that's their bonding style. I don't know. Sharing might be their thing. But I'm not sure there's rules that you can learn for who to trust. And that's something this character is struggling with a lot. Who do you trust and why? How do you know? And when you are this sort of anxious, avoidant person, it's very hard to figure it out because, you know, often these people have very strong boundaries because they've been hurt a lot and they don't let those boundaries down very easily. And so knowing when to let the boundaries down is, or let the barriers down, is very difficult for this character. The dining hall is always this sort of nexus of stress in this story. Like, I mean, I'm sure that's true for a lot of people. You go there and who are you with? Who do you sit with? Do you sit down alone? Is that weird? Is that awkward? Is it uncomfortable? What if you go sit with somebody? Oh, well, they were waiting for their five friends and they're like, "Well, actually I'm waiting. You can't sit here. Sorry." I mean, I don't know what happens. It's been a very long time since I was in college and I didn't go to a dining hall. Dining halls terrify me. But a dining hall is kind of like the sacred cheese of life. It stands for something else. It stands for social gathering and connection and all those currents between people that are so hard to track and so scary when you're not connected. Like, if you go there with your friends, it's fine. If you go there alone, what is it like and how is that experience? And I mean, now people are mostly like, oh, if you're alone, you're just on your phone and nobody cares and you don't care and nobody notices. You know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago is a different story. So yeah, that's Becca. Becca's in a problem situation narrative-wise because I have not rewritten her and I'm really struggling. Okay, so here's my rewriting strategy. And this I did learn in the MFA and I'm sorry to keep talking about it. But this is Mary Helen who taught me this. Mary Helen Stefaniak? Yeah, taught me this like the first week or something. Because I said, how do you rewrite a novel? And she sat down and showed me. She showed me her files. So here's what she said to do. Because I always used to struggle with rewriting a novel. I would write this big mess and I'd be like, great, how do I fix it? What in the world do I do? And I would like make little dabs at it. Like, I'll fix this spot. I'll fix that spot. And it would just be a big mess and I could never find anything. And so like I would correct this one narrative thread and then it would mess up everything else down the line and I couldn't track it. Okay, so here's what you do. Stefaniak method, I called it. You break up your document into chapters. This is my adapted version. You break it into chapters, logical chapters. Okay, now you make an outline. Chapter one, what happens? List the events, okay? Chapter two, what happens? List the events, etc. Okay, good. Now you read the thing. You read it through without stopping to make notes. Don't make any notes, just read it. Read it and get a sense of the shape of it and the flow of it and whether it works as a story and what it is missing, like all of those lovely moments between people that are actually what we're there for. Oh no, you didn't write any of those? Great, just remember that. And maybe when you get to the end, write a bunch of notes, but don't stop constantly or you lose the flow. Okay, now you go through and read it again and you start making comments, like add comments in your document. Highlight things. I highlight a lot of things because I will look at it later and I'll be like, ugh. But if I highlight it, that makes me know, oh, I know that. And this is a problem spot. So I highlight things and I make comments in the little comments function. I try not to change anything this read through. Like, don't get bogged down making changes. Okay, so this goes back to something I learned a long time ago, which is that there's writing brain and editing brain, and they are different skills, and you shouldn't even do them in the same place in the house. I edit at the desk. I write on the couch, right? Or in my comfy chair. I don't edit in the comfy chair. I can't really do it. I don't do it very well there. I write on my laptop. I edit on my desktop computer, which is my work computer, where I am right now. I sit in the office chair at my desk, and the cat gets in her cat cave, and the dog gets in her dog bed, and everybody knows it's work time. And whatever you can do to give yourself that psychologically, like, they have hats who sells these writer hats, like Final Draft or somebody? Whatever it takes, just be like, this is work time. And that's where you edit. Because editing gives you a drop in those fun brain chemicals, whatever it is, I don't know, dopamine, serotonin, I can never keep them straight. Whereas writing a first draft gives you a huge rush of them. So if you go into it expecting the rush, you're going to be double disappointed, like not just not plus, but also minus. You're going to be in the hole. Do it somewhere else. And also keep writing a first draft of something else so you get the fun chemicals, but do it somewhere else, right? Go to editing and do that. Read through, do the notes, do the comments all throughout, and then tackle it one thing at a time. It's so discouraging when you're just like, I'm going to go fix the draft, and you can only do a tiny bit, and then you're like, I did nothing. That's if you're all or nothing thinking like me, which, I mean, that's a real problem. I tend to feel like I haven't done anything unless I finish something, which is obviously you can't do the whole thing in one. So make a list, make a shopping list. I do this. On my outline, I will have a shopping list. I want to fix Becca's arc with X. Okay, I'm going to go find all those spots because I have an outline now that actually corresponds to the document. So I can go find every time Becca goes to see her therapist. Good. Okay, I'm going to write all of those. I'm going to go through and make sure all of those are good and they follow an arc. All right, put that on my list. Becca's therapist visits. Good. Now I'm going to go through to them all, and then I get to cross that off, and then I get that good feeling like I finished something. What else? I was going to put little, I forget even the word for it, at the beginning of the chapter where there's a little quote, you know? I was going to have quotes from her old therapist, like meetings with her old therapist, who is a huge figure in this story, even though she's no longer among us, which sort of gets revealed later as things go, because she's so present in Becca's life that you don't even realize she's died. Because she talks about her in her own head so much. That's awful. But also, you know, she's still there doing good, even though she's not there. So I was going to have those at the beginning of the chapter. Okay, put that on the list. Go through and add all of those. And these are just jobs you can get done, right? Go through and add, this is my actual list. I have to write all the movies she's making. She's in a film major, and so she has to make all these little short films. She's got this monster of a teacher who says, like, I want a short film every week. This is kind of how I used to teach screenwriting. I used to make them write 10 pages every week, and I'm not going to grade you on the quality. I just want the quantity, because the only way you ever get good at writing is writing a lot. And they would get so precious about formatting and all this stuff. I'm like, just do it. And so 10 pages a week over 12 weeks, and they had a screenplay, and it needed to be rewritten, yes, but, and then I would give them comments every week. So I've given her a monster teacher like me, who says, I want a short film every week, you get a zero if you don't do it, you get full credit if you do it, and I'm going to give you notes, and I'm going to give you feedback, and I'm going to tell you how to do it better next time. And so they do that, and so she has to make all these little movies, right? Which means you have to find friends to work with, unless you do it all on your own, which is really hard with film, because who's the actor, right? You can't be the actor and the director, or you won't be in shot. Ask me how I know. So she has to find people to work with, and she has to work together and help other people on their short films. So that's on my list. Becca's movies. You have to write them. There's also a show she's obsessed with, which I've never fully developed. That's on my list. Develop Becca's obsession show. It was supposed to be like a, I don't know, like how people get obsessed with, who, me? TV shows, and think about them all the time. And she made a lot of little movies with them. She's like, I guess it was originally YouTube, but now it would probably be TikTok. Made a lot of short films of her favorite show using action figures, right? And doing all the dialogue and all the stuff, and just gained a huge following doing this, and had all of this money coming in because of it. And that's how she paid for college. But I haven't developed the show properly. So I've got to develop that and make it her obsession. Because there's always somebody who's so obsessed with a show that they forget about real life, right? They would rather go obsess about something nice and safe, especially an avoidant person, than deal with messy reality. And so part of her story is letting go of that show and moving into the real world, which sucks. It's so unpredictable, whereas your show is nice and safe. So anyway, that's my list. I've got a lot to do. Now I actually really want to get cracking on it. So thank you for that. So that's what we're doing, right? Inspiration for reading and writing. Maybe I need to use a lot more sensory material. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to look at a story. I'm going to try to use it in what I'm writing. And I'm going to work really hard on keeping up with myself and being accountable about the writing. editing because Becca really needs to get finished. Becca, you're awesome, but you need to get finished so I can move on. I did start a new novel, so that's my dopamine or whatever. I will also look up whether it's dopamine or serotonin, so whoever's shouting it, I can hear you eventually. Okay, so that's my deal. If you have any questions or you want to suggest a text to work on, my email is sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com, sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com, and even if you just want to have feedback, let me know. Cut out all the parts where your dog is clicking around or your dog is barking or your dog. Yeah, the dog is going to be present. I also live on a very noisy road. I don't think you can hear it, but maybe. With, you know, semis doing engine braking down the hill, which is my favorite, isn't it? So loud. You can't even talk on the phone with the windows open in this house. It's great. Okay. Anyway, it's going to be noisy, and I apologize for that. And hopefully I can figure out a way around it. And I think the mic is trimming out a lot of it. We'll see. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I will talk to you next time. Bye. Oh, and of course, Sacred Cheese of Life.